So today, what I want to do is I want to continue looking at fundamental belief in number five, which is sin and God's law. The last time we covered the first part of the fundamental belief, which reads, "We believe that sin is the transgression of law. The law is spiritual, perfect, holy, just, and good. The law defines God's love," right? Much as what John talked about, that God is love, and we can use the law to define what God's love is. And it goes on and says, "And it is based upon two great principles of love towards God and love towards our neighbor. It is immutable and binding." Right? So we looked at, in part one, you know, I'd probably say that the biggest focus is that at the core of God's law is love, right? "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Love for God and love for mankind, right? On these two, Christ says, rest all the law and the prophets. I mean, you think about it, how much of the Bible is the law and the prophets, and it's just these two, what you could say, very simple principles that they all rest on, right? And logically, you know, love being at the core of the law makes a lot of sense, right? We know that God is love, right? The Bible plainly tells us that that is how we can understand love, that it is, or that we, how we can understand God, that he is love, right? And then it would make sense that God would codify, you know, help us understand what love really means, right? And so this is how we should think about God's law, right? It's the codification of God's principles of love regarding how we are to interact, how we are to treat, how we are to think about, how we are to act towards both God himself and all of those around us, right? All of those who have ever lived, all of those that are living today, and all of those that will ever live. I mean, you can think about, you know, we know that our decisions today affect not just us, not just those around us, but will ultimately affect all those that will to come, right? Things that we do today, things that how we act, how we treat each other can be passed down generation to generation. You know, God makes clear that those choices that we make can be passed down seven generations or even more. All right, so it's very important to understand and understand what God's love means. And one of the best places to start is the law, right? It's these principles that he's given to us, right? And we can know with great confidence that with the law, even as it is written, you know, thousands of years ago, that once it's codified, it won't change, right? Because again, the Bible declares plainly that God doesn't change. So whatever we read, no matter how long ago those things were written, they still speak to us today. They still tell us how we are to act, what we are to do, and how we are to understand God and his love, right? And so we can count on those things. And it's, you know, in many ways, it's directly opposite from what most today believe, right? If you think about society today, most of the things, you know, people don't believe that there's a set truth, that things that were true, you know, 10 years ago, 50 years ago, much less 1,000, 2,000 years ago, are still true today, right? They believe that it's something that we can change over time, that it's something that basically, you know, it just depends on how you feel. Does it feel right? Does it, you know, is it something that you accept somebody? Does it make them feel bad, right? If it makes them feel bad, then it's probably not the right thing to do. So it's very different how mankind views law and views love than what God's way does. But in this second part, what I want to do is I want to go deeper into this concept that love is at the core of the law, and look at how we can use the law as a very practical exercise to understand what God really means by love, right? How he views love, how he loves each one of us, and how he expects us to both love him and love one another. Right? And this is a very important point to remember, right? It was one that the Jews had forgotten by the time of Christ, right? They believed that the law could impart righteousness in and of itself. And while the law is righteous, it's this concept that love underlies God's law that they missed, right? They didn't understand, they didn't, you know, believe, you could say, that for them to rightly apply the law, they had to do it in the context of loving one another and loving God. Right? And so you can't understand the law without understanding that at its core, the law is this codification of God's love. Right? It's a practical guide of things that we either shouldn't show or should show if we want to love God and mankind. And by following the law, right, by exercising our following the law, we can learn how to show love, how to show godly love. Now, we know that we need to go beyond that, right? As Christ said many times, we have to go beyond just the physical keeping of the law to spiritually applying the law. But, you know, as we see with young kids, first they have to go through things very simply, and they have to repeat it time and time again. And as they repeat it, as they become proficient at it, then they can understand more deeply, right? And that's, as we think about, that's what the law was given to us for, right? It's for us to exercise the simple application, but not just stop there, go beyond that. Understand the principles that underlie the law so that we can apply it in many different situations, you know, that we can apply it every day throughout our life, that we can apply it all of our interactions, right? Be those with the people in this room or people outside of the room, that we can continue to practice and become more like God. Right, and as I'd mentioned last time, that's why I think this is a very practical fundamental belief, right? It's something that we can use as a basis for deepening our relationship with the Father and with Christ, right? And our relationship with each other. Those sitting in this room first, but really all of those that we come in contact to, or even all of those that will come after us, right? Because as I said, anything that we do today, anything that we, you know, make habits, anything that we as we interact with each other, anything that we do affects not just those of us alive today, but those that will come, right? And we can look at very many examples in the Bible where people use law as a basis to build a deep relationship with God. Right? And if you look at it, you know, especially King David is probably the biggest example of this, right? He, you know, if you look at David, you know, why did he have this deep relationship with God? Right? It's because he loved the law of God. We see this throughout all of the Psalms, right? Where he says, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day." Right? These are words of someone that knew God's law. It wasn't just some abstract thing for him. It was something that he thought about, that he used throughout his time, throughout his day, to know God. Right? And we know he sinned. He sinned greatly. But it's actually this deep knowing of the law, right, that actually would bring him back to God, right? Would have him repent. And then he knew, right, that God, in all of his tender mercies, would embrace him again, would bring him back, right? And this is, you know, what caused David to love God all the more, right? He loved God all the more for the fact that every time he sinned, he knew he could go back to God and God would put him in a right place, right? And this is true of the other great men of the Bible. You know, all of them knew God's law. All of them sinned, yes, but they knew what sin did to them. They knew what Christ, though, had done to him or would do to him. And they all loved the law of God and loved God because of it, even though it convicted them of their sins. Right? And so this is, as I say, a very practical way to start to know God, to start to know what God is and to know his love. Now, you have to go beyond it, no doubt, but it sets the basis for us, our understanding of him. Right? And so today, I actually want to just cover one point of the fundamental belief. So this is kind of the very middle of it. It says the Ten Commandments are the 10 points of God's law of love. And I want to focus on this one because, as I said, I want to try to get, you know, a bit more practical. What does it mean that these are 10 points of God's law of love? How can they deepen our understanding of God? How can they deepen our understanding of his love? And how can we apply them and also all the rest of the law in a very practical way as we go throughout our day? Right, and so to begin, looking at this, I just review a few things, and you know, as I want to do in all of these, look at what we say in our fundamental beliefs, and do they come from God's word? Right, and so you know, as we look at this one point, the Ten Commandments are the 10 points of God's law of love. you could ask yourself why the Ten Commandments are so important, right? I mean, that's just a small section of the law overall, right? And I won't go back and cover why we call it God's law of love, because I just spent, the last few minutes talking about it. So I think that point is clear why we say it's God's law of love. But why make the Ten Commandments, you know, front and center of this practical application of God's law? You know, yes, traditionally they're things that we memorize, right? We learn them from an early age. Probably the only part of the law that we've actually put to memory. And, you know, they're the part of the law that most people know, right? Most Christians or even a lot of non-Christians would know them today. But I think it's good to refresh why they're important, right? I mean, it's not just for tradition's sake that they were important. And we have to make sure that it's not just for tradition's sake that they're important, but we need to understand the emphasis that God puts on them. And so to begin, I want to start in Deuteronomy 4, verse 1. And if you turn there, we'll be in Deuteronomy for the next few minutes. It says, "Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you." And I think I've used this section of scriptures, or kind of this section of Deuteronomy, quite a bit. But just as a refresher, right, this is Moses talking at the end of his life, not to those Israelites that had come out of Egypt, but talking to those Israelites that are about to go in to the land of Canaan, about to go in with Joshua and possess the land. And as you kind of look through, you can see that this is probably Moses' last official address to the nation of Israel. Not long after this, he, of course, leaves and goes off and is able to see the promised land, but doesn't actually go in. And the children of Israel so depart from him, and Joshua becomes their leader. And so, you know, he's recapping some of the most important things that he has to impart to the second generation, right? It's not the ones that had gone through it per se, even though they might have gone through some of it. It's those whose parents had gone through it and had failed. And so he's reminding them what are the most important things for them to remember. And so that's the context of, you know, this of what he's about to say here. So moving on to Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, it says, "You shall not add to the word which I commanded you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you." And he goes on to say, and he goes on to talk about other things, and I won't read it for the sake of time. But then dropping down to Deuteronomy 4, verse 9, it says, "Only take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, and teach them to your children and to your grandchildren." You know, and as I said, if you think about it, as he's talking about these things, you know, these were children of the people that had gone through it. And so for whatever failings they might have had, that first generation, you know, they at least had talked and taught their children these things to the second generation, right? And you can only imagine, as they're wandering through the wilderness year after year, how much they would talk to their children about not following in their way, right? Not doubting God, not departing from his word, but to stick to God, you know? And so whatever they might have done, you see at least their children not following in their example. And so here Moses, you know, is telling him basically do the same things that your parents did, you know, teach your children, teach your grandchildren. And going on in verse 10, it says, "Especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord said to me, 'Gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children.' Then you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire in the to the midst of heaven, with darkness, cloud, and thick darkness. And the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but saw no form. You only heard a voice. So he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, the Ten Commandments, and he wrote them on two tablets of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that you may observe them in the land which you cross over to possess." Right? And so Moses is making clear that the words God spoke directly to the children of Israel were to be the focus for them, right? This was the heart of the covenant that he had with the children of Israel, right? And Christ rightly puts the greatest commandments on a higher level, but Moses here is emphasizing the importance of the Ten Commandments, right? They're the heart and the soul of the covenant that God had with the children of Israel. And so, you know, it's Moses here that's putting the emphasis on these Ten Commandments, right? And as we go on, and we'll look at this interaction between God and Israel that Moses is referring to, because it shows, you know, even more the importance that these Ten Commandments had, right? And so let's turn back. It's Exodus 19 and verse 17 is where we'll begin. And this is, you know, the children of Israel are at Mount Sinai after they had left Egypt and had crossed over the Red Sea. And so they're here at the foot of the mountain, right? And this is Exodus 19, 17. It says, "And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in the fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him by voice." And just, I won't read it, but if you recall, there's actually quite a bit of preparation for the children of Israel to get to this time, right? God had commanded all of them to be sanctified before this happened. And he commanded none of them to approach the mountain, but he wanted them all to be, what you could say, in a state of holiness, right? Sanctified before him as he's about to talk to them. And so moving on to Exodus 19 and verse 20, it says, "Then the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, and many of them perish. And let the priests who come near the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them.' But Moses said to the Lord, 'The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, "Set bounds around the mountain and consecrate it."' Then the Lord said to him, 'Away, get down and then come up, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priest and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them.'" Right, and so we see here that the children of Israel had, you know, based off of what the Lord had commanded them, had put in preparation so that they wouldn't go up to the mountain. And then moving on in Exodus 19 and verse 25, so Moses went down to the people and spoke to them. And then moving on to Exodus 20 verse 1, and it says, "And God spoke all these words, saying," and so then it goes on and he gives the Ten Commandments. Right, and so if you think about it, these Ten Commandments were the only words that God directly spoke to the children of Israel, right? If you think about that, that's, you know, God himself places a great emphasis on these Ten Commandments. You know, it's not, these aren't something that we can dismiss or treat lightly. These are, you know, something he felt it was so important that he was going to impart them very directly and in a very powerful way, right? You know, as we'll see as we read on, you know, him, the way he spoke, you know, frightened the people. It was with such great power and great authority, and with all of the, you know, thunderings and lightnings and the fire, it would have been a sight to see. You know, I imagine I would have been right there with all of them being kind of terrified of seeing this sight. But, you know, when he had this opportunity, or when he took this opportunity, God did, to speak to the children of Israel directly, the things that he imparted were these Ten Commandments, right? And so you can see by this, God himself places a huge emphasis on these. I mean, realistically, these are the only, only things that he has spoken to a wide number of people, you know, probably in the millions, that he took the time to communicate these Ten Commandments. And I won't go through and read these for sake of time, and hopefully we all know them very well, but that's what the next set of verses go through in Exodus. But we'll drop down to Exodus 20 and verse 18, where it says, "Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, "You speak with us, and we will hear you, but let not God speak with us, lest we die." And Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin." So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. Right, and so we see, as I said, that these Ten Commandments were the only direct words that the Lord spoke to the whole of the children of Israel. The rest of the law, right, all the statutes, all the judgments, all the things that Moses wrote down came from God, but they came through Moses, right? And so this direct declaration of these Ten Commandments between God and the children of Israel emphasizes the importance of these, right? As Moses said in Deuteronomy, these were the heart of the covenant that they were making between God and the children of Israel. Right? And so, at least for myself, I have this kind of mental model of how all these things go together, right? How the law kind of goes together, right? You know, at the bottom, you have this foundation of the two great commandments, love God and love your neighbor, right? And these are the driving principles that we will have for all eternity, right? Even when we're spirit beings, right? We're going to have these same principles. We are to love God and we are to love our neighbor, right? Yes, we'll be spirit beings at that point, but this is essentially, you know, the two things that will last forever, right? We know that the other parts of the law, as they were always intended to be, were temporary, right? Temporary through the whole, you know, time of human beings. But as we become spirit beings, we, you know, will likely have other things, but it's realistically these two principles that will last forever. But then on top of those, well, and if you think about it, these two, you know, if we had the mind and the character of Christ and God the Father, these would really be all that we needed, right? These are all that they need. These are all that they follow because, you know, God is love. And so these are the principles they follow. But God knew that we would need more than just these two principles, right? Because, you know, as I said, you know, society today has a very different definition of love than what God does, right? And so as we're humans, we can get off track if these are just the two principles that we use, because we need to understand how they're applied, right? How they apply in different circumstances. We want to make sure we would apply them in the same way that God would apply them. And that is then what these Ten Commandments sitting on top of the two great principles do, right? They help us understand what the practical implementation of God's love are, right? They're broad, but they still apply to many of the situations that we face, right? Just with these Ten Commandments, we could understand most of the interactions that we have with one another, right? How we are to act, what it really means to love God and to love our neighbor, right? And we see Paul makes this tie between the Ten Commandments and the two greatest commandments in Romans. And we'll turn over to Romans 13, verse 8. And that's Romans 13, verse 8. Paul says, "Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments," and then he goes on and tells specific commandments, right? It says, "You shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, are all summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law." Right? And so we see Paul using, you know, what we would say the portion of the Ten Commandments that are directly derived from the principle of loving your neighbor as yourself. You know, he makes this tie together. And from here, we can logically think that the first of the Ten Commandments come from the principle of loving God as yourself, right? As we read through, that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, we see this principle here of the foundation being the two great commandments, and then the Ten Commandments sitting on top of these, some being derived from the principle of loving God, some being derived from the principle of loving your neighbor as yourself. But even these Ten Commandments, right, can be difficult to apply to every situation that we face, right? And that is where, if you think about it, this broader set of statutes and judgments and commandments come in, right? By looking at this broader set that Moses passed down from God, they become even easier to apply to specific situations, right? To understand what God would do in a given situation, because we can look at these commandments, these statutes, and these judgments, derive very specific principles out of them, and then use them practically in our life as we interact with one another, right? Because the rest of the statutes and judgments and commandments, they talk about very specific situations, and we'll go through quite a few of them today. But as we look at them, you know, they help us understand really how to apply these two broad principles of loving God and loving your neighbor. And then from this, you know, we can understand in any given situation how we can apply God's love to the interactions we have with one another, you know, and with God as well. So let's first look at a couple of the Ten Commandments and see if we can understand what, you know, principles, how they tie back to the two great principles of loving God and loving your neighbor. So the first one that I want to look at is the Sabbath commandment. So this is in Exodus 20, verse 8. It says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." And this, I think, is actually a very interesting one to apply, or to try to apply and see how these show love to our neighbor and love to God, because God actually lays it out here and how he goes on and explains this commandment, right? Most of the other commandments, you know, he basically gives the commandment and then moves on. But here, you know, he talks or he explains a little bit more, right? And so let's look at this and see if we can apply, you know, this law of love, how we can understand that by following this commandment, it shows love. So the first one, right, is showing love to God, right? And if you think about it, the broad principle is that when he declares something holy, right, then we should keep it holy. That when he, you know, makes something holy, that we should keep it holy. That he has this power to command things as being holy or not holy. But when he does command something to be holy, we have to always make sure we keep it holy. Right, and we see this principle in many other places, right? God has declared us holy as his children, and we're told to keep, you know, ourselves holy, to keep ourselves away from unholy things, right? Or another example is Nadab and Abihu, right? If we think back about that story, you know, what did they do, right? They took into the temple, which God had, or not, sorry, not into the temple, but into the tabernacle. They took into the tabernacle, which God had declared holy. You know, God had made very clear that the tabernacle was a holy place. But what did they do? They took in profane fire, right, and were killed for it because they didn't keep something God had declared holy as holy, right? And as we go on and kind of look at that story a little bit more, we see that they, you know, at least it implies that they might have been drinking before this, because right after this situation, God tells Aaron that, you know, the priest, when they're on their priestly duties, aren't to drink. But kind of regardless of what they did, you know, they didn't take what God said seriously, right? God had said that the tabernacle and the fire were holy, and they were only supposed to treat it a certain way. But they didn't do that, right? They kind of were lax in how they treated something that God said was holy. And so if we look at this Sabbath day commandment, you know, God has declared it holy. He explains why he declared it holy, right? Because he says he rested on the seventh day, and it says, "Then the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." So essentially declared it holy. And so just the fact that God declared it holy should be enough for us to keep it holy, right? That principle of making sure that anything God declares holy, that we keep it holy, that should be the principle for all of the things that God declares holy, that we are to, you know, put an extra emphasis on doing the things that God says to do around something that's holy. And so when God says, don't work on the Sabbath because he made it holy, You know, one of the ways that we can show love to God is by keeping things that are holy, holy. But then let's look at another way that this Sabbath command shows love to our neighbor, right? And if you look at, as I said in Exodus 20, verse 10, it essentially tells us how we can show love, right? So we'll just read this again quickly. It says, "But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates." And so notice what it says here, right? It says here that, you know, you are to keep the Sabbath day holy, and you are to not do any work, and all of those that you are in charge of, you shouldn't make them do any work. So how does this show love for one another, right? When I read this, what it reminds me of is in the New Testament teachings where it says we are not to be a stumbling block to those who are weak, or not to cause a little one to sin, right? And so if you think about it, these words are very interesting, because God commands, you know, you and I individually to keep the Sabbath day holy and not to work, which is the right thing to do, of course. But then when he goes on and explains this commandment, right, it says, don't make those who, you know, you are in charge of or who are over work either, right? Because if you think about it, right, you could keep this holy, but then, you know, make someone underneath you not keep it holy. But is that, you know, showing love to them? Is that, you know, if you made them work, that would be forcing them to break God's law, right? And so that's not a loving thing, right? That would be the equivalent of putting a stumbling block before them, right? So you know, it's not enough just that you keep the day holy, even though you should, and that's a very personal thing, right? But you can also make sure that you don't put a stumbling block in front of someone else. You can make sure you don't make them sin, you know, leading, essentially, if you think about it, to the death penalty on them, right? Because if you force someone underneath you to work, then the death penalty would apply to them because they broke God's law, right? And so this ties back very much to this principle of loving your neighbor. You can't, you know, love your neighbor and cause them to sin. And so part of it is, you know, as a very great principle, we need to look back and understand in our interactions with one another, you know, if we're causing one another to sin, even if we might not be sinning, we can still, through our actions or through what we do, cause another person to sin, right? And as I said, in the New Testament, it goes into a lot more examples of how this might happen. But just from this one of the Ten Commandments, we can see that principle being applied. We can see, you know, by extracting what it's saying, extracting the deeper meaning of it, that this isn't just about the Sabbath, right? Even though we need to understand that, it's a deeper principle that says, as we interact with people, particularly people that, you know, we might be in charge of or we might be over, we need to ensure the things that we do, even if they're not sin to us, that it doesn't cause someone else to sin. And so it's, you know, a great principle, and you can start to apply this in many different ways in our lives and in our interactions with one another. And so let's look at one more of the Ten Commandments and how we can, you know, think about it in a deeper way and see what principles we can draw from it. So we'll read in Exodus 20 and verse 17, it says, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's." Right? And the first thing I think we'd naturally think about is how this applies to the principle of loving your neighbor as yourself. Right? Because if you think about it, right, if you're coveting what someone else has, that's not showing love for them. It's not showing happiness for the things that they have, for the things that God has given to them. And, you know, especially as you think about coveting something that someone else has, what are you going to covet, right? You're going to covet the things that they have that are nice, that are good, right? You know, maybe they have a big house, a very beautiful house, or maybe they have, you know, a donkey or an ox who's stronger than your average donkey or ox, right? Or maybe their male servant is someone that could, at that point, go out and, you know, cultivate a lot of grain, right? So you would think about when you covet, you're coveting those, the best things that someone else has. And by coveting those things, you're essentially saying that that other person isn't, you know, isn't worth having those nice things, or that you're better than that other person and should have their nice things instead of them, right? And so you're being, you know, you're not being thankful for the good things that they have in life. So there's no way that you can love your neighbor, right? Because if you love your neighbor, you're going to want them to have many good things that, you know, might be better than yours, right? And this is, you know, one of those things that we of course struggle with all our life, but, you know, particularly you see with little kids, right? If someone has a toy that you want, what are they going to do? They're going to go up and try to grab it, or they're going to, you know, want it, you know, cry about it, you know, or if someone else has, you know, a little bit more cake or two cupcakes instead of one, you know, what's a little child going to do? They're going to want what that other person has. You know, even if they have something nice themselves, they still see someone else that has something nicer. And that is, of course, you know, a wrong attitude and something that we have to grow out of. But, you know, just by that very fact that you want what that, the good things that that other person has, you're implying that you, you know, what you want or what you think you need is more important than that other person. And so you're not showing godly love to them, right? But even from this commandment, this 10th commandment, we can also look at how this doesn't show love to God, right? Because think about this. Who has given you everything that you have, right? It's God. God, you know, promises that he will give us everything that we need, right? And many times he gives us things that are way beyond what we really need, right? Things that we want, things that we desire, because God, you know, as he says, is that loving father, that he wants us to have the good things in life. But by coveting what your neighbor has, what are you doing? You're questioning God. You're questioning God and what he's done for you, right? As I said, we know that God has given us everything, but if you think that by coveting what your neighbor has, that he hasn't given you enough, you're denying what God tells us, right? You're calling essentially God a liar. You're saying that he hasn't given you everything that you need, or he hasn't given you those things that are going to be good for you, right? And so if you think about, you know, this law, and how we can apply it and how we can, you know, derive a principle out of it. Part of this is telling us that, you know, when God gives us something or whatever situation that we're in that God has placed us in, you know, we need to be thankful for it. We need to have that belief that God is doing what is best for us, what is good for us, and that we shouldn't always be grasping for more, right? We should be patient, right? And if God wants us to have it, he'll give it to us, right? We know from so many of the great stories in the Bible that there's nothing that God can't do, right? I mean, he has done so many miraculous things that when he knows that you need something or knows that you want something and he decides that it's good for you, he'll give it to you, right? There can't be any questioning of that. And if we have that faith in him that he's going to do it, you know, we will live a very content life, and we will, of course, follow this 10th commandment because we won't covet those things that other people have. We'll be thankful that they have those, that God has given them great and good things, and we'll be patient in understanding that God will give us, you know, those things that we need and those things that he knows are good for us. And so these is, you know, there's probably more that you could do, but these are just some of the examples of how we can look at the Ten Commandments and derive kind of principles that we can apply time and time again. And for the sake of time, I won't go through any more, but I want to look at, you know, some other examples from the other commandments and statutes and judgments that God gave to Moses, and see, you know, how we can derive these principles. So the first one that I want to look at is Exodus 22, verse 6. And it says, "If fire breaks out and catches in thorns so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed, he who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. Right? And, you know, if we think about this, this probably sounds right. But, you know, while some of us burn fires and those kind of things, you know, not many of us have stacked grains or standing grains anymore. Not many of us have fields that can be consumed by fire. But what principle of love can we derive from this? And there's actually, you know, two interesting points here, because the first is about personal responsibility, right? As we go about our day and as we do things, we have to make sure that what we're going to do doesn't negatively affect other people, right? You know, in this case, you know, it's unlikely that somebody is going to, you know, start a fire and intentionally try to burn someone else's grains. You know, this isn't what it's talking about. It's talking about, you know, you start a fire, and for whatever reason, that fire gets out of control, right? You're not being as careful as you should be. You're not maybe watchful on that fire. You haven't prepared by having enough water if it starts to get out of control. And so that's what it's talking about. This is talking about, you know, those things that we probably do unintentionally just because we've been careless or we haven't prepared enough, right? But then it affects someone else negatively. And it says, you know, what we are to do. We're to make restitution. We're to restore what that other person lost because we were the ones that made the bad decision. And so, you know, while we can't necessarily apply this exact commandment in our daily lives, we can apply the principle of what it means, right? Do we, you know, maybe unintentionally break something of someone else's? Well, if you do, you should buy them, you know, a new thing, right? You know, let's say you spill someone's cup of coffee. You should go buy them, you know, another cup of coffee to restore it to them. You know, let's say you accidentally, you know, drop someone's phone, as an example. What's the right and loving thing to do? You should go out and buy them, you know, another phone, the equivalent phone, right? And we see this in places. If, you know, if you cause an accident, what should you do? You should restore that car to them. And so, you know, from this, we can actually see how it applies in many different situations of our life. And like I said, I mean, it comes down to love, right? God has given someone something. And if you're the one that causes it to be broken or to not work anymore, or to be taken away, you have a responsibility to restore it to them. You know, yes, it'll, you know, harm you. You'll be out, you know, some money or time or whatever it is. But that's the right loving thing to do, is to restore to someone something that you have broken. Let's go on and let's look at probably just one more. We'll turn to Exodus 21, verse 28. It says, "If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted." Right? And so it says, you know, just by the fact of having an ox that gores someone to death, that you're going to be out, you know, that ox, right? It's going to be killed and it's not going to be restored back to you. And so you have, a certain level of responsibility that you have to ensure, you know, the things that you have, an animal or, you know, your car or whatever it might be, that it's used in a proper manner. But then it goes on in Exodus 21, verse 29, it says, "But if the ox tended to thrust with its horns in times past," right? And so, you know, in this case, you might think about a dog, right? If a dog has been aggressive or has bitten somebody in times past, right? Not many of us probably have ox today, but we can apply this in a different, you know, in the way that it is applicable today. But it goes on, it says, "And if it has been known to his owner and he has not kept it confined so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and the owner shall be put to death." Right? And so what this shows is two things, right? It shows first, you know, as I said, personal responsibility, that we have a responsibility to understand those things that we're in control of, whether they can be harmful to someone else, right? And if they are, or if it could be, we should keep them, you know, locked up. We should keep them away so that it's not going to do harm, right? You know, a great example of this that we unfortunately hear about too much today, right, is people that leave their guns kind of out in the open for some young child to get into. And what happens, you know, as I said, more than it should, you know, that, you know, a child will get into that weapon and will either kill themselves or kill someone else. And so here, you know, we can take this law and apply it back to that, right? God has this standard for us to have that if something is potentially dangerous to someone else and we as the owner know about it, we have an extra responsibility to make sure that it doesn't harm someone else. And then the other one is the value of life, right? If we have something that kills someone else, then it's on us, right? I mean, it's the same as murder. And that's what it's saying here is this, you know, ox that tended to thrust its horns. And if it kills someone, you're responsible as the owner of that you didn't keep it, that you didn't keep it up, that you're responsible for murder in this case. And so, you know, God has this value of life, and it's not loving to one another that we put people, you know, that we would put people in harm's way. And so there are many more examples like this. These are just a few. You can go, you know, really commandment by commandment, statute by statute, and understand, you know, the principle underlying them, understand how they can apply to us today. Because, you know, on the surface, many of them you can kind of read and say, I don't have an ox, so what does it matter? Or I don't have a field that I would burn a fire in, so it doesn't matter to me. But these, you know, because they're very practical applications of God's law, of God's love, we can understand what God's love and God's law really mean, right? And so, you know, as we kind of close here, I would, you know, recommend, I would say that, you know, we should all spend time in the Old Testament studying these laws, meditating on them, gaining this deeper understanding of God and Christ, right? Because if they're love, then knowing how they would apply love in different situations, we can start taking on their mind and their character, right? We can start getting to the point where all we need are the two great principles, because we so much understand how they would act and what love really means to them, right? And from this, we can use it to build a relationship with them, right? Both when we follow their ways, but also when we sin, repent, and then come back to God, right? By understanding this, we get a deeper understanding of what repentance means, you know, what it means and what the consequences of sin are, right? This is what David did. This is what other of the great men of the Bible did. And so, you know, if we believe, you know, what we say in our fundamental beliefs about these Ten Commandments and God's law, then we can't do otherwise. We have to spend time studying them. We have to spend time understanding them, deriving the principles that they can teach us, right? That's the only way we can say that we really love God and love His law, is by understanding what they mean and be able to apply them to our everyday lives. Right, and so closing, I'd like to read the full fundamental belief number 5, sin and God's law. It says, we believe that sin is the transgression of the law. The law is spiritual, perfect, holy, just, and good. The law defines God's love and is based upon the two great principles of love towards God and love towards neighbor. It is immutable and binding. The Ten Commandments are the 10 points of God's law of love. We believe that breaking any one point of the law brings upon a person the penalty of sin. We believe that this fundamental spiritual law reveals the only way to true life and the only possible way of happiness, peace, and joy. All unhappiness, misery, anguish, and woe have come from transgressing God's law.